Beautiful to see this event happening. Kol hakavod, shkoyach to all the organizers and all those who came, who really are a part of making it happen. When we think of dreamers, we think of scattered people, people who are not the managers, not the budgetary people, not the orderly, in-the-box people. The Jewish paradigm of a dreamer is a little different. The Jewish paradigm of a dreamer is Yosef. Yosef HaTzadik. Yosef HaTzadik is the only one of the Avos. He's already part of the Toldos, but he's still in Bereishis, part of the Sefer HaAvos, who we call Tzadik. Tzadik because the process of Tzidkus is step after step after step. It's the process of remaining within a framework. It's the process of responding, so it would seem, to a given imperative. And yet, Yosef is the Baal HaLomos, he's the dreamer. And he's no ordinary dreamer. He's a dreamer who is so passionate about his dream that he holds, that it's, as the Ramban puts it, he held that it was a prophecy, it was a nevuah, and he pursues that dream doggedly at great cost. He doesn't send a message to his father that he's close by and that he's alive and well. And Yosef achieves his dreams in the end of days. If we want to be Baalei Chalomos, if we want to dream about the future, we have to understand that Jewish dreams are rooted not in some kind of unusual creativity and out of the box, but it's rooted in a spiritual vision which we believe in and hold so strongly that we're willing to doggedly pursue it out of Tzidkus, Yosef HaTzadik. And for Yosef HaTzadik, the world yields. He gets put into every situation and comes out on top. He gets put in Potiphar's home and he becomes the leader of that home. He gets put in a prison house and he becomes the leader of that prison house. He becomes ultimately the Mishnah Lamelech in Mitzrayim. And the Torah tells us that, the Beforshim of the Torah tell us that life doesn't yield to Yosef HaTzadik because of his creativity. Life yields to him because of his tzidkus. So if we want our dreams, if we want not only to dream, but if we want our dreams to come true, then it is the pursuit of tzidkus which has to be our daily bread. We are involved in dreamlike stuff. We're involved with something which nobody anticipated in terms of a natural historical cycle. It's something rather ahistorical, something that goes beyond the normal rules of what one could have predicted according to the rules of history, the Baal Teshuva movement. But that is just what the Jewish people is all about, living according to meta rules of history, living above the waves of what sociologists and anthropologists and historians would have predicted. Now this story, if you want to understand it in this context, goes back to the French Revolution. Because what happened in the French Revolution, it's just dated, it's at 1778, even though it took place over a couple of years, was something which ultimately led to what we call the emancipation of the Jews. Took a while. Didn't happen overnight. Even after liberty and equality, freedom of religion was declared for everybody, the debate was, does everybody include the Jews as well? The person who took it forward in a great leap was Napoleon Bonaparte. It was a great reaction against the French Revolution. By the name of Robespierre, oversaw the death of 40,000 people and the imprisonment of 500,000 others. And that situation led to Napoleon, by the end of the century, 1999, coming onto the scene. And for the next 17 years, on and off, a little visitation to the island of Elba, but on and off, leading a revolution. And wherever he came, wherever he went, he opened up the ghettos and he freed up the Jews. When Napoleon went, there was a lot of backsliding, and it took most of the part of the 19th century for that emancipation to gain permanence around Europe. And the Jews were offered that emancipation. The issue not only of whether somebody was going to be Jewish arose, but for the first time, how one was going to be Jewish, a question that never arose before. Before, there was a clear derech, it was a Torah derech, there was no other derech. You could choose, perhaps, from the 18th century on, between Hasidus and being a misnaged, perhaps. But you didn't have any thoughts that being Jewish wasn't to be expressed in terms of Torah and mitzvahs. And suddenly, there was a wave of multiple different expressions that led to the first Kiruv attempts, if you like. Most famously, Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch in Frankfurt am Main, and many of the great Sfarim that we have today that we draw on, the Malbim and the Ksava Kabbalah, Rav Mecklenburg and others, Rav Wolf Heidenheim and Kavonis HaMikra, were written specifically in response to this wave of emancipation. For a Jew at that stage, to leave Judaism meant to become a Christian, not as an act of religious expression, but as Heinrich Heine said, as the ticket to Europe, just as a door opener. And in Eastern Europe alone, we know that 250,000 Jews did that. In Western Europe, the figure was much higher. We had figures like Disraeli, who became Prime Minister of England, whose father baptized him at the age of 11 years old. He claimed that he was the blank page between the Old and the New Testament. And just 7 years later, somebody who had come of a great rabbinic family, Karl Heinrich Marx, was also converted to Christianity. But the phenomenon of intermarriage did not yet exist. Assimilation, yes. Intermarriage, no. But the attrition of the Jewish people had begun, and it began in waves. In waves and waves. On the one hand, the secular demands on Orthodox rabbis in Germany in the 19th century was minimally you had to have a doctorate in order to be an official rabbi of a community. On the other hand, that attempt to show that we could, for want of a better way of saying it, the secular people, was only minimally successful. Most of our comrades, most of our fellow Jews, left Orthodox Judaism in one form or another. The specific Jewish expressions of these were in some kind of religious form in the West, Reform, high critical theories, other things. In the East, they were more the isms of Zionism and Bundism and socialism, etc. We moved in, just to give an idea, between 1880 and the First World War, 2.5 million Jews moved from Eastern Europe and Russia to America. Those 2.5 million Jews, Eastern Europe, received the Haskalah much later. They were nominally Orthodox, at least. Within a period of 2 weeks to 2 years, Al Pi Roiv, almost all of those Jews left Orthodoxy. The entire bunch. Had those Jews stayed Orthodox, North American Jewry would have known a huge Orthodoxy, a very tiny Reform, and probably no Conservative at all. But they didn't. And they left. And they kept on leaving. In their droves, in Europe, in America, wherever they were Jews, we kept on going backwards. And there were great attempts to stabilize the situation. Young Israel sent out, right, created a whole host of synagogues, some with mechitzas, some without mechitzas, but all under Orthodox banners. But to be a successful rabbi right up until the 50s was to say that at the end of your career, your community hadn't shrunk. It was the same size as when you came in. Great people. Rav Nachman Bulman Zatzal, who was one of the great Makarvas of the Balshiva movement, who had thousands of Talmidim by the time he was Nifter. That same Rav Nachman Bulman, before the movement came, had that same experience of going out, I think it was to Richmond, Virginia, and Bokoshi maintaining a status quo. But in the main, things were going backwards. And then the Balshiva movement began, and we thought things were looking more rosy. We know that the intermarriage rate remained very high. But at least the Orthodox core would now expand with, let's just say, the 70,000 Balei Tshuva or so that's returned during those 30 years. But it was not so. The figures didn't show any increase. Despite the fact that the Orthodox had a very high birth rate, despite the fact that the non-Orthodox had substitution birth rate, 1.4 children per two parents. Despite the fact that all the intermarriage to talk of was from the non-Orthodox. Despite all the indications that the Orthodox should have grown as a massive percentage of American Jewry. There was no increase over 30 years. And there's only one explanation for that. By my calculations, 300,000 people in those 30 years who grew up in Orthodox homes left Yiddishkeit. We were losing them still at an enormous rate. What was happening was those who remained frum, rose their standards. There was more learning, there was a higher level of kashrus, there was more observance, but anybody who was holding on the edge moved out. There were no Jewish Observer articles about that like there was for the teens at risk, which is a tiny percentage compared to that, a couple of thousand. The people I'm talking about, 300,000. And the reason was because they weren't on our streets. They weren't problems. These were successful people at a college age or young marrieds who would move out into suburbia and just wouldn't rejoin an Orthodox shul. They just slipped out of Yiddishkeit. The Balshiva movement, despite all the rah-rah, had yet to turn the tide. And it's very interesting to note that the Nesivos Shalom, at the end of his Hakdama, his Sefer Amidos, talks about the three post-Holocaust events that are of great historical significance in our time. The first one he says is the rise in Torah learning, the number of people learning Torah, the level of Torah knowledge within our communities, unprecedented possibly in the history of the nation. The second one, he says, is the Baal Tshuva movement. And the third is the movement of intermarriage. But he says, and this is very important, they really, intermarriage and the Tshuva movement are two different sides of the same coin. Ein ben David ba ele bedor she'o shekulo zaka o shekulo chayev. The Mashiach will only come in a generation, which we normally translate as, where the entire generation will either be Zakai, and therefore we'll be at the level of Yemos HaMashiach, and therefore Mashiach will come b'meila, or Shekul HaChayev, which we normally translate as, will be so low and so spiritually vacuous that we won't be able to hold on, and Mashiach will have to come, or we're done for. Says the Slonimah, that's not true. What it means, and I heard the same shot in the name of Rav Elyolopian, is that this will be a generation of clarification and of extremities. The middle will fall out of the Jewish people. You will no longer be able to be a nice, traditional Jew who learns a bit and who keeps some mitzvahs. Either up you will go into full observance, into passionate embrace of the Torah and its values, or down into the abyss you will go, into the pits of assimilation and intermarriage. There will be no more middle. Or Shekul HaChayev, either each individual will be Kulu Zakai or Kulu Chayev. It's going on the individuals. And the old models would no longer work. And this is what we saw happening. Those people who were orthodox in a very basic kind of a way began to slip out in very large numbers. Those who stayed in began to raise the level of their observance. The Baal Tshuva movement greatly embellished that with the tremendous passion and idealism of those who came in. As the Baal Tshuva movement unfolded, it too had its historical stages. Started off as a radical concept by Meshuganas, Teref Nasan Lireyav, says the Pasuk, David HaMelech, Briso Yikon La'ad, I think is the say for the Pasuk, which means Teref Nasan Lireyav, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives teref. What is teref? To his yireim, to those who fear him. Says the Chofetz Chaim, teref adas. He makes them meshuganas. Why does he make his yirei shamayim meshuganas? Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to do certain things in this world, and he wants to do them through his yirei shamayim. But yirei shamayim are very mesudadika people. They are tzaddikim. They are Yosef Tzaddik, and they get up in the morning and they daven and they learn and they want to look after their family and they want to have a panas and they want to come. Your day is full. There's no time for anything else other than your personal avodas Hashem. Being a Ben Torah is a full-time thing. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes his Yireim and he turns those that he needs into Meshugayim, that they'll say, we'll go out and we'll makarev and we'll do the Ratzon Hashem in unusual ways. And in that way, and that's the sefer of the Pasuk, he will be Makayim, his bris. I heard this in the name of the Chofetz Chaim from a Talmid of the Chofetz Chaim who heard it directly from him. The Chofetz Chaim is significant in another way, because the Chofetz Chaim already, at the end of the 19th century, declared, and every Gadol since then has declared, every Gadol since the Chofetz Chaim, that besides the normal Avodas Hashem that each individual has to do, there's a tzorech hashar, there's a great urgent need, which requires our particular attention, which demands from every Eved Hashem attention. And that is the hemorrhaging of the Jewish people. The Chilul Hashem that the majority of the Jews of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's people, the majority of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's people are not keeping his Torah. And the goyim see this. And it's an enormous chilul Hashem. They realize the implications of that much more than we do. Most Jews, most people who stand up and say, I am a Jew, do not care to keep any of the implications of what that statement means. And so we had these people like Rav Noach Weinberg Zatzal and Yibod Lechaim, Rav Mendel Weinberg and Rav Natas Schiller and Rabbi David Refson and many others, but all very unusual people, big people, tzaddikim, dreamers. Yosef HaTzadik. And when they looked for people to continue, the Bnei Torah said, nothing doing. We ain't. HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't give us Tiruf Adas. He turned you into a Meshugana, but I'm a normal guy. I'm balanced. I've got my Avodas Hashem to do. And it was mainly the Baalei Tshuva, the Talmidim of that first generation who carried on the work. Until only about 15, 16 years ago, when several things came to play simultaneously, and Bnei Torah in tremendous numbers, and I don't mean to imply that those early Baalei Tshuva were Bnei Torah, but they were Bnei Torah who were particularly committed to that cause. They had come from that world. They felt they had a karas atoyv. They wanted to give back to that world. They understood how they could give back to that world. Firstly, there was the Kodal movement. The Kodal movement provided a great, let's call it, transition for Bnei Torah. Bnei Torah couldn't imagine himself going out and doing kiruv, but he could imagine himself going out to a city and sitting and learning some siddurim, and then as an extension of that, doing some kiruv. It was something that he could, sitting and learning in the mir in Yerushalayim, he could somehow picture. And came along the training programs, which provided a two-year transition that a person could commit now to something which didn't require them to actually do something now other than to learn about it and inquire about it. That transition helped. And the yeshivas themselves became so full and so overflowing that places like Lakewood and Chofetz Chaim and others, Bnei Yisrael set up, had dedicated staff whose whole job it was to get people out into these jobs and find positions for them. Unprecedented that the yeshivas themselves should be looking to get people out of their own yeshivas and into the field. And that was a beautiful wave of the Baal Tshuva movement, a wave that set things up, set up schools and set up kodalim, set up communities. Many of the Rosh Chabura of the Kodalim didn't just go out and see themselves as setting up a Kodal. They saw themselves as taking achrayas for a city. And then came the last big wave that we've seen, and that was the campus movement. North America campus, we'd call it. The movement for targeting students. Only 6 years ago, I counted three full-time people on campus in North America. Perhaps I missed a few. There were plenty of people who visited campus as a part of their kiruv activities, but dedicated people who saw themselves as committed to campus. It was a completely new phenomenon. I remember when Mr. Horn and Mr. Wilson made this deal. I happened to be sitting there at the time and turned to me and said, well, how many people can you find to go onto campus? And I thought for a bit and I said, four, I think. And Mr. Horn said, well, we're wasting our time then. And I said, Mr. Horn, we're not wasting our time. This is how we started out in the beginning. We don't know where the people will come from, but they'll come. Today, around the world, literally around the world, South America, in 80 different locations in the former Soviet Union, across Europe, you can go into a place in Budapest where people had tried for decades to do kiruv and nothing seemed to work there, and you go and you see 8 shiurim simultaneously, a Beis HaMidrash humming with young student-aged kids growing in leaps and bounds. You go to Berlin, you go to Odessa or Dnipropetrovsk, you go anywhere you want to, and you see places that never dreamt, places that didn't dare to have Yosef's dream, are seeing this whole new population coming through the door. And the question is now, Quo Vadis, where do we go? What's the next step? What are the new frontiers? Just more of the same. Noel Aleph has 1,200, close to 1,300 graduates in the field today. That's 1,300 jobs that we never thought would exist before. We didn't make those jobs. The people went out, right? People like Mrs. Yagobian. Where are you? Just happened to. Right, would go out, and her and her husband would make a kahila and a school, and then they would have to employ people, and they bring more people into the city, and etc., etc. And I could probably say that that's generating effects of any one of you sitting in this room today. There's a very interesting book called The History of Scientific Revolutions by a fellow who was at the MIT, Thomas Kuhn. I don't know whether he's still alive today. He wrote in the mid-60s. And Thomas Kuhn noted a very interesting thing. He said, what happens is that science moves along, putters along, and then suddenly somebody makes a massive discovery. Copernicus, Newton, Einstein. And then, after that discovery, it seems to stabilize again. And then, again, another revolution. It goes in revolutions. It doesn't make continuous progress. And if you look at the people who make that revolution, usually they make it when they're very young. And very often, like Einstein, they don't do much by way of new chidushim in their later years at all. And he explained this was because people start thinking in a paradigm. They start thinking within a certain framework. And when you're thinking in that framework, the framework dictates to you the type of questions that you can ask, and therefore the type of answers that you're going to get. You don't think of questions outside of the paradigm, they're not legitimate. The type of questions, he says, are essentially puzzles, not real questions. And therefore, science doesn't make that progress until somebody very young who wasn't fully trained in the paradigm, somebody brilliant, thinks outside of the paradigm and creates a new revolution. When he gets older, he in turn becomes fully trained in that paradigm, and he's no longer capable of thinking out of it, and he doesn't make any more chidushim. When we sing the Shir HaMaleis of benching Shabbos and Yom Tov, we say Hayinu Kachelmim. We will be as dreamers. What is that kind of a dreamer? The Pashup Shat is when we will reach that higher level of perspective called Yomos HaMashiach, we will see that the paradigm that we were working within, the type of thinking and perspective that we had about reality, will be relative to that new higher level, just a dream. After all, Yosef HaTzadik, the most accurate dreamer of them all, in the end, was also of a level of Ayin Kochelmim. He became the king of Egypt, or the Mishnah of the Melech, but he didn't become the king of Israel. David HaMelech was not from his lineage. David HaMelech was from the Baal Tshuva, Yehuda, not from the Tzaddik. After all, the Ark comes to Shiloh, which is in Shevet Ephraim. the iron, and it stays there for almost 400 years. That's a long time. But it doesn't stay there. Hayinu Kecholmim. Ultimately, it's destined for the Beis HaMikdash and the tribe of Yehuda and Binyamin. Literally in Binyamin, just next to Yehuda. But it's Binyamin who stays with Yehuda in the next dream. And that is when Yosef breaks off and creates a kingdom of 10 tribes. That's 10 of the 12 tribes. 10 out of 12 places went to the Republican Party or to the Democratic Party here, we'd say it's a whitewash. It's complete power. They can do whatever they want. But it was Hayinu Kecholmim. Those 10 tribes get lost. And only the remnants of Klal Yisrael remains. And that's Yehuda and Binyamin. But then what do we call that remnant? We call it Sheris Yosef. The remnant of Joseph. Of Yosef the dreamer. In an ironic twist. Because that dream doesn't get lost. That dream has a cue. That dream might not have been the ultimate reality at which Klal Yisrael has to operate, but it's a bridge. Zoisasu v'hichu, says Yosef to his brothers when they see him as the Mishnah Lamelech of Egypt, and they don't know he's Yosef. Do this and you will live. Follow me, follow my Avodas Hashem, ki arela kim aleichi, because I am a God-fearing person. And if you don't follow me, you will not have the bridge of the Kedusha of the Avos to the Kedusha of the Banim. Yosef was that force that transferred the Kedusha of the Avos to the Banim. The Baal Tshuva movement, we, the Makarvim, are that kind of a dreamer. We are that force which transfers the Kedusha of the Avos, the Torah that always existed in Klal Yisrael, and we make sure that those out there whose Torah it is, Morashak Hilas Yaakov, it's a Yerusha of everybody. If you can teach somebody Torah and you don't, you're a thief. You're stealing his Torah, it belongs to him, not just to you. And we're making sure that we're the bridge, as Yerael Akim, as that Terif Nasan Lireyav, as that Tiru Fandas. So, we're forced to dream. Even though we know that when we will get to a different stage, we'll see in turn that whatever dreams we had were just so much fluff compared to the higher levels of reality that we'll see then. And so, we need to take a review. And problems there are plenty. It's not so easy to make kelim anymore. The obvious places all have kelim. When Robertson Felsen and her husband went out and planted a flag in Palo Alto, the last of the obvious places, or even not so obvious places, were conquered, right? And now, you know, there's plenty of places that there's a Jacksonville and there's a, goodness knows, there are dozens of places where we might think a Charleston, where we might think of making a kettle, but they're not. They're not as obvious and as easy as the former places. And the Chofetz Chaim schools, they don't have a short list of those places where they can easily just come in and make a new school. Doing these things requires a certain population, a certain support, a certain infrastructure. That model they don't expect to be able to duplicate in the same way as before. And it's no surprise that already last year we found 5 Chofetz Chaim graduates on campus. And we expect to see a lot more, and we expect to see them in other positions as they are forced to broaden the opportunities for their growing kelel of keen and eager Avreichim. And we're all short of money. Not only that, some of the things, some of the models that we thought we got right seem to go backwards. Jewish day schools. Suddenly there will be, by September the 1st, 2011, nine charter schools, Hebrew charter schools, in the United States of America, just south of Canada. And nine charter schools means that in many cases, parents will pull their children out of Jewish day schools. Some, 5%, 10%, 15% of those charter schools that are not allowed to provide Yiddishkeit. It's one thing to have Peter Deutsch's school in South Florida providing a voluntary after-school program provided by Afikim, which has 80% of the students attending. It's another thing to have the types of schools that we're beginning to see, where you'll learn a little bit of gobbledygook Hebrew and that'll be it. People can't afford it. Can't afford the average, I'm taking a guess, an educated guess, that the average school fees today in America, if you'll take the high and the low, is coming out to $13,000 per kid. We're just not making that kind of money. I know one Makarov, his house is in foreclosure, is making a salary of $200,000. I thought, no, he's not making it. He's genuinely not making it. So we got lots of problems, and we got lots of issues. But we don't go forwards by telling ourselves about how difficult it is. That's not how we dream. That's not how Yosef HaTzadik dreamt. You think you got problems. Just imagine dreaming while you're a slave in the house of Potiphar, dreaming while you're in the dungeons of an Egyptian prison. Just imagine dreaming then, and he never stopped. And we should never stop. So we have to begin to talk about the next wave. So let me talk about a few things. Just a few. So I'll start with money, because that's the lowest priority. And we'll go mina kalala kaved. Recently, Bill Gates and Melinda Gates and Warren Buffett created something called the Pledge. The Pledge was targeting those Americans who were part of the Forbes 400 and getting them to pledge 50% of their money to charity, preferably during their lifetime, and if not, during their death. We're talking about the wealthiest 400 people in the world. They're up to 80 something now, 87. When they hit 40, there were 17 Jews on that list. I don't know. I can't say for sure that all 17 are halachic Jews. Certainly I was able to verify that 13 at least were halachic Jews and probably more. I wasn't able to verify all of them. Those 13 Jews pledged in new money by taking the pledge a total of $17 billion. New money. Okay, $17 billion. Now by my calculations, the entire Baal Tshuva movement around the world is spending currently round about, if you include Chabad, between $500 and $750 million a year. That's also mucho. But, alright, it's nothing like $17 billion. Only two of those 17, going back to the 17, not the 13, had a portfolio, a specific portfolio in their charitable structure, however they structured it, as an independent foundation in most cases, for Jewish causes. Most of that money, as it stands now, just given, left to its own devices, will not touch anything Jewish, let alone the Kirov movement. That doesn't mean to say that we shouldn't dream. So, I'll tell you something, which is, I'm just telling you just So you understand the possibilities. Two of these Uraim, Tirufadasniks, a person by the name of Rabbi Joss Spinner, who's the president of the Lauda Foundation, and a person by the name of Rabbi Rafal Kruskal, who's one of the two partners of Odessa, which is a giant, magnificent operation in the Ukraine. And they have everything from orphanages, schools, kollel, yeshiva, cheder, Beis Yaakov, restaurants, anything you could dream of. They've put up there. And they came to me and they said, let's go off to somebody. So we decided, we'll go pitch 10 people for $1 million to put in for a fund for Europe, just for Europe. Now that's why I can afford to tell you, otherwise, last time I mentioned something about money at an AJOP convention, there was a long line afterwards asking me to write checks. So from now on in America, I only give examples of outside of America. So we went. I met Mr. Ronald Lauder in Leipzig. And I said, Ronald, will you help us raise this money? And Ronald Lauder said, I'll go with you to anybody you get me into. Just tell me when and where, work it into my schedule, and I'll come and I'll help you pitch. Later on, Rabbi Spinner said, confirmed that he'd also put in $1 million to this fund. We went to a second person. Person said, I'm in. We went to a third person. Person said, I'm in. And at that stage, we called, and the whole thing collapsed, or at least we're given a one-week reprieve. Now, we're just doing this for fun in our spare time. Okay? This is not our day job. It's just to show you, okay? It's just to show you that the money's there. There isn't a shortage of money. There's one fellow by the name of Alan Proctor who lives in Muncie, New York, who was given a psak by Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky to dedicate his life, he and his wife, to targeting money that is not being given to Jewish causes at the moment. And he's had some significant successes. He's reached some mega people who've shown tremendous interest in getting involved in this. Will his dream come true? Will our dream come true? We don't know. But we know that if we don't dream, and these are dreams of tzidkus, these are not dreams of lining our own pockets, these are dreams of going beyond the parameters of parochial needs. All of us, and other people that I've spoken to about this, we've all agreed that if it's going to be this kollel and that kollel and this kiruv organization and that startup community, we're never going to get that money. Because this type of person, the type of person that we're talking about, the Forbes 400, the pledge type of people, they need global visions. They won't go for a local vision. You need to come into them and you need to sell them something which is going to be of dramatic import. And on our own, we are done for in terms of that money. We'll never get it. If we don't combine our forces, if we don't create new visions together, we will never touch that money. And so we are going to have to network and think in different ways. We are going to have to change our paradigm. It's no longer my operation and your operation, and we'll all get together for a three-day conference and say, rah, rah, rah. There's going to have to be something after the 3 days too, if we're going to go further in a dramatic way, reaching the types of sums of money that we want to talk about. I can tell you stories of, it's not for now, we don't have time. I can tell you stories of 5-6 Russian oligarchs that I've met who I've never been able to give them what they've been looking for. I've never been able to give them enough of a project that they would come in. I was just in this place, the Dnipropetrovsk, which is a Chabad place. There's real Torah going on there. Tens and tens of Balei Tshuva. The minyan in the morning was was packed out, 150, 200 people really davening. And it was just a little tip of the iceberg of what was going on there. And that building is seven buildings. The community center, the central one, is 28 stories high. You just imagine what's going on, etc. And it's two local guys. It's two people in the city who got caught by this vision. Whether that's where the edifice complex, you know, is the way to solve the problem of the Jewish people is a separate discussion. But I'm just giving you an understanding that that wherever you go, there's tons and tons of this money. It's just for want and lack of a proper approach, a proper action plan. It's for want and lack of a proper vision, of a proper dream on our part. I can tell you that for some, it's special interest projects. We've done very well developing places, making sure that we've taken care of our romantic urges. What do I mean when I say that? Romantic urge means we're going to put something in Houston. Okay, we got something in Houston. Good, we can go to sleep now. Okay, never mind the fact that Houston desperately needs another 10 communities, right? That Houston needs all kinds of, right, schooling and other things and second phase things. We, on the outside, we feel we can put a pin in the map, right? Houston's taken care of. Phoenix, let's make a kettle in Phoenix, or let somebody make a kettle. Good, I'm feeling better now. We got something. But that's not the way it goes. If you go to these cities, I just flew here now from Atlanta. And if you take out a map of Atlanta, where there are in greater Atlanta today 130,000 people, so there should be a community here, and there should be one here, there should be one here, there should be one here, there should be one here. There are at least 10 communities that we should be aiming to establish in that one city. We're not even methodical about it that we can even say such a thing. We're not even methodical enough that we can pull out a master plan and show somebody. And say, look, we've mapped it out. And here is how we'll train the people. Here is how we'll put them out. And here is the backup services we'll give them. And this is the timetable. And this is the cost. Nobody's even taken the trouble to try and present such a vision. We did, by the way, for students. Donors came and said, Mr. Horner, Mr. Wilson, we have, at that stage, there were 22,000. This will be about 30,000 continuous students, which means students who come for a semester or more of involvement around the world. And they wanted to know, how could we bump it up to 100,000? The reason 100,000, because in the age group that we're dealing with, 100,000 is about 10% of the population in that age group, Jewish population. And the feeling was, if you could reach 10%, then you've made a dent. You've done something, and that should be the goal. And we went city by city and analyzed each city, what resources there are there and how much we would have to add in order to reach X number of students, and where we would realistically find 100,000 students. Now, it's a lot of work, but it's eminently doable. And when you have that, you inspire people. You inspire your supporters to do things that they would never have dreamt of doing if I would have just said, help me, Makarov, 50 students in Rome or Brussels or any one of the individual locations where we haven't gone in. We haven't mapped out or we haven't really attacked the special interests. In America, I would call the special interests the Israelis, the Russians, the Spanish, the Persians. After all these years, we know that whenever a serious operation gets established targeting one of these special interest groups, they have been successful. RAGE for Russians in Brighton Beach is one of the most successful Q organizations in the United States of America. Another one is EMET in Queens targeting Bukharim. I guess you'd say that's cheating, right? Makarov in Sfarim, you don't get the same credit. I can tell you that it's not... Right? It's not a piece of cake. These people These people work from morning to night, and they have a magnificent operation. We have here and there little operations targeting Israelis. We have a beautiful idea from Rabbi Zev Dunanel to establish schools for Israelis, and he's piloted one in Miami. We have a lovely operation in Chicago. We've never done it in a methodical way. All right, we've never said there are Russians here, 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 and here, and how are we going to trade them, and where are we going to go first, and what model are we going to use, and let's go to some of these huge, big, mega givers and give them a vision, not of one place, but of a whole national vision. I suppose if Rabbi Tarkovsky would be here, I'd be very upset. Tell me that he does that all the time. We have, if you talk about the romantic phenomena, if you want to know where the least per person kiruv is being done in North America today, it's in the largest cities. Per person. Okay? You have 1 million people living in New York City. You have 20% of them are Orthodox. Okay, so you have 800,000 non-from people living in New York City. You've got another 500,000 living in the suburbs, of whom only 10% are Orthodox. 12%. So you've got, of that, 500,000, right? So you're up to about 1.3 million non-from Jews living in the greater New York area. If you would measure the total reach of the Kiruv organizations in New York City, as the most obvious example, but go to South Florida, and it's even worse. Go to the Bay Area, go to San Francisco in particular, right? 200,000 Jews. And it's slim pickings in terms of the Kiruv that we're doing there. Go to the northern suburbs of Chicago, and we've got a few tiny little operations. The biggest cities are the least serviced per percentage population. And then we have to keep track of the changes that we are going to have to do in terms of what's happening to the changes out there of those Jews who are showing some kind of an interest. There was a fascinating set of studies, one done in America, one done in Europe. The one done in America was done by Avichai. And Avichai did a study. When do you want me to stop yanking?
We want to do questions too, if people have questions. So you have an hour and 15 minutes. So
to finish 3:30. To finish?
3:45.
Right?
3:45,
okay. 3:30. 3:30. So there was a study done, a reasonable sample of the young leadership. Jewish leadership in the United States of America, specifically excluding Orthodox people. And they found some fascinating things. They found that the profile of these young leaders, they reached, I think, about 2,000, quite a big sample. They were all very educated Jewishly by secular standards. They'd been to Jewish day schools. They've been to Jewish camps, they've been on Birthright, they've been to all kinds of things. Most of them married Jews, and most of them wanted their children to marry Jews. So far, so good. Now, here come the surprises. Number one, although they wanted to keep their own lineage Jewish, they felt it was wrong to say that everybody else should marry a Jew. It was parochial. You cannot give an authentic Jewish message out saying that you should marry a Jew. Number two, J Street is right. What I mean by that is that most of them felt that you had a right to criticize the state of Israel, and that many of them felt uncomfortable about the current political positions that Israel held. Number three, they felt that functions that were held should not be held only for Jews. that you should be inviting non-Jews, not because of the reform position that we have to makarov non-Jews to do a two-hour gairus in order to increase our reform temple non-attendance on Shavuos, but because they felt that Jewish concepts of inclusivity demanded that we expose the whole world to our universal message. And therefore all our events should be inviting of non-Jews as well. And number four, and this is very important, listen well. Most of these people wanted to do their own startup thing. They didn't want to join the federations. Some did. They didn't want to join established organizations. They wanted to create new cutting edge things that were not going to be affiliated. The most prominent of these initiatives are these non-affiliated minyanim that you have today. Right? And there's even now one on the web. A virtual minion. Everybody sits in the office and they all come on together. Whether it's in the area of arts or culture or learning Hebrew or etc., they didn't want to become a part of a big movement. They felt that the authenticity of the Jewish people was expressed by local initiatives. And you have major secular organizations that today just embrace that reality after trying to get these people on young leadership missions for the Federation and all kinds of things. The Schusterman Foundation, for example, now appointed somebody, a very major league guy, just to find all these initiatives and to support them. Not to say, hey, come and join us, but to say, hey, can we help you network with each other? And to leave it at that. And I can tell you, in Europe, we find the same thing. The same kind of phenomena. Much less educated. Much less able. And some of them are in a Frum direction. A group of professionals in Frankfurt on Main. The leading couple. She's a lawyer. And he works for an American company in social networking media. And they started a Kirov group. Mrs. Levine can tell you about it. She's been in touch with the women. And the people that they got involved were also Balaba. And they don't have any professional. Not yet, at any rate. They're a model which we're not used to encouraging. We're not used to empowering people who are not Kirov professionals, people who are not affiliated, people who are out there. We don't even know how to do it. We don't know how to find people. We don't know how to... I, in Odessa, now attended a seminar where there were 350 people. This seminar is held 3-4 times a year, usually with between 350 and 500 people from the former Soviet Union, all high-quality leadership student material. They are coming off a game which is called the brain game in Russia, where questions go up on the web a few hours before. You could download it like you have 3 hours to download it and then to answer the questions, and they work in teams competing all over Russia with each other. It's called the brain game. That brain game was started by a guy called Zev Merims. How did Zev Merims get started? It's a magnificent thing out of the box. This is Levine, you know about Zev Merims. Here's your address for all your further information. Zev Merims was at a seminar that we were running. And I took people one by one and I said, tell me your ideas. And Zev Merims told me his idea. And I had 200 euros in my pocket and I pulled it out and I put it in his hands and I said, Zev, go and do it. And Zev Merims said, I'm going to do it. He says, but I don't want to take your money before I've done it. And he gave me the 200 euros back and he went and he did it. Orthodox startup doesn't just have to be for those way out leaders who are, by our standards, very peripherally connected to Judaism as we know it. we're falling behind in certain types of thinking. You know, the Kirith movement used to be cutting edge in many different ways. But recently, for example, the day school movement, Liminehem, Orthodox and non-Orthodox, have done certain things and we haven't even sat up and paid notice. The Avichai Foundation gave Pej $2 million, which is not a huge amount of money, but it's nice money, to start to create a framework to encourage schools to create endowments. And the goal of the endowments, there are 30 schools in the experimental stage, 10 in New York, 10 in Baltimore, 10 in Los Angeles, is to have $20,000 per kid, okay, during his, in order to reduce fees, in order to make it possible. The project has gone underway. Tell me a Kirith organization that's got an endowment fund. Tell me a mega body like Pej that services the Orthodox Kirith movement that would go and solicit an Avichai to create all the know-how of how you do this, how do you sell it, and how do you package it, and where do you invest the funds, and what should your return be. Fifteen years ago, we were at the cutting edge of everything. And we need to be back there again. Way, way ahead. Because I'll tell you one incredible thing about the Baal Teshuva movement. What makes the difference between the Baal Teshuva movement, the Makarvim, of this Baal Teshuva movement that got that name, and all those people who went out to try Makarav Yidden before then? If you will have listened to my historical scenario, you would have heard that up until the 1970s, it was a maintenance operation at best. People were just trying to keep desperately the status quo to some degree, and they were failing. Because the forces of history, for whatever divine plan, went against that. The Chiddush of the Baal Teshuva movement was that the Makarvim didn't accept the status quo. The Makarvim came and they said, we are for transformation. If I come into a kehillah and there are only as many people davening in that kehillah 10 years later as when I came in, I'm a failure. And we set those standards. We don't accept status quo. We are the Yosef dreamers. So we have to look at startups. We have to look at different educational methodologies. There are many cutting edge. We had this program which was stipends for students called STARS in the former Soviet Union. And we did an evaluation and we found that of the 3,500 kids that were coming in 80 different places, they were not the best quality of the kids. They were not the leading, winning kids, right, who were Jewish. We weren't attracting them. And we had to do a turnaround. So we created a thing called STARS Platinum. STARS Platinum was really, you could only do STARS Platinum if you accepted the whole package. Firstly, we said no more classroom situation. Round tables, dynamic and interactive. No more frontal teacher. Okay, as one person put it, Rabbi Pantelat, it's akin to a blog. A blog, and the response to a blog is more about, not about one person teaching somebody something, it's more about communication. People today don't want to be told, they want to communicate with you. And sometimes, for them to communicate to you is much more meaningful for them than for you to communicate with them. And the question is, how do you guide them to Torah under circumstances like that? Well, there are leading thinkers. Hamayan, an organization in England, takes school kids to Gateshead for a comprehensive seminar, which had many different elements, but one of the elements was that every class has to be interactive. It's now already a parallel organization to Hamayan. And they would, if it was the boys, for example, they had over 3 years, these are school kids coming from very basic, like secular Jewish day schools, they would walk them through 3 years of Gomorrah, in successive seminars, 2-3 a year, and they get them to tell them lamdas, that the kids would produce the lamdas. The Rav Chaims and the Tzaises and all the beautiful yeshivish things. Kids had never learned Gemara before in their lives. By asking the questions and probing them and say, that's excellent, now what about this? And if the kids didn't say it, they wouldn't tell them. But the kids did say it. And we created the stars, platinum, in such a way that there were very short segments accommodating the very short attention span that we're dealing with today, that were interactive, that had movie components. And by the way, a movie is no longer frontal. A movie is on all four walls, wherever you're sitting, on a round table, that you could see it. And people had to invest in the equipment. And the difference is phenomenal, overnight. My time's up. I have other models that I wanted to share with you. It doesn't matter. The point is that this is a block. That we have to begin a communication. That we have to dream beyond our current models in order to embrace the next wave of the Baal Teshuva movement. Thank you. Anybody have any questions? Yes.
I'll be brave. How do we tap into all that money that's out there?
Oh, why do you always have to bring up money? I told you how to tap into it. If you're asking that question about your organization, you're not going to see it.
I'm giving you some models.
I'm giving you some models. And in fact, people began to pursue those models, right? For the Cradle Movement, in fact, there is today somebody working with us, Rabbi Menachem Deutsch of the Atlanta Cradle. How did Rabbi Menachem Deutsch come to be working for us? Because he went to Ira Wilson and he said, I have a national vision of how the Kedilim can all get together and fundraise together and produce much greater results. And Aaron Wilson said, you want to talk national? I've got a national offer position for you. Become the national campus coordinator. And he accepted. Beware of what you ask and who you ask it of. But the point is that people have begun thinking in those ways. People have begun thinking in those ways. For example, today, let me give you just one other example. We have, for example, today in Israel, this summer, 750 kids on trips that the actual trips themselves are paid for 75% by the foreign ministry. They call Hasbara trips. Now, we don't know. It's a big experiment whether it's going to work, whether it's not going to work. According to my report from somebody in the field just before I gave this talk, 10 minutes before I gave this talk, so far, so good. Okay? How did the foreign ministry come to fund the Kiruv world? Talking about megabucks, it's 1,000 kids this year in a trial, and the vision from both sides to go up to 5,000 kids a year if it works. And that's just only one source of government funding. I went through a list of 15 different projects, some of which already exist and some of which are in the process of advanced discussions, that our projects around the world are engaging the Israeli government on, various different departments and ministries. The reason we were able to do that was because we were able to combine all the campuses around the world, and we were able to go say to them two things. We said, one, you keep on training 15 leaders, 20 leaders, 30 leaders, and they look behind them and they say, okay, off to me, and then there's nobody there. Okay? You don't have the numbers. We're not coming to offer you leaders, we're coming to offer you troops. People who will be inspired Jews, and this is the second point. You keep on trying to train people to love Israel and to defend Israel, but these people don't even know whether they want to be Jewish or not. You can only do it in the context of giving Yiddishkeit. And I can tell you, we sat with the heads of departments there, the head of the ambassadors department. There were about 15 of all the leading people from the CEO of the foreign ministry. None of them was religious. And they all accepted. They all accepted that this was perfectly true to the point where they're finding it. So, you know, if you would have come to me and said, well, go to the foreign ministry and ask them, I would have said, are you kidding? Do you know who they are? Do you know how far away they are from Judaism? Do you know, what? And yet we see that when we have the courage and the daring to try something a little bit different, something that might not have worked 5 years ago, I can tell you that had Nehru Elif started 5 years before it did, it would not have succeeded. The circumstances were not right. And if the Bolshevik movement had started 10 years before, it would not have had Paris to show. There is a Chaloi Siyata Deshmaya that comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? And you have to tune and tap into that. It's not always so easy to sense, but when it's there, you can do what you couldn't do yesterday. And I had the feeling, and it seems posher to me, that the closer you get to Yom HaMashiach, the more we have that overflow of that Kedusha from Yom HaMashiach, the easier it will be for us to do big things. Because we're really tapping in to sources that are getting closer and closer to us as our door progresses. Yes. What's your name?
Ayala
Bay. From?
From Hope Gardens.
Welcome.
I'm
from Velcom in South Africa.
We're the people in the field. Like, we have our little thing going on in our local community. So it's somebody, this big vision person has to be sort of outside of us, and to like tap into that big thing and then trickle it down to the field. No? The words are escaping me.
It's true that one model is to do a top down, take, you know, that same handful of Rabbi Ephros's, right, who visits and networks with all the communities and, right, who could tell you exactly which highway to get on at, depending on the time of the day that you're getting on the highway in order to get to the next Kiruv stop, right, on time. And I'm only saying that to show the immense detail and understanding he has of each kahila around the country. A real bracha, and to come with a vision, right, and Rabbi Ephros and others are not short of visions, and to do it. So basically you're saying, you know, Edelstein, so what are you talking for? You know, get off the podium and start uniting us and do something about it. That's one way. I appreciate. I understood the message very clearly. Okay, Rabbi Ephros, you want to speak? My answer to you is,
Mrs. Gobi was not happy with your answer, and she's going to talk to me later. So. The question is how do you take the big picture, these big visions that attract people who spend big money? Why? Because they also work with big visions. The reason they're looking for big vision people is because that's the way they work in their own worlds. That's how they succeeded the way they succeeded. Okay, but there is such a thing as, you know, Tip O'Neill. Does anybody know who Tip O'Neill was? Tip O'Neill was a representative, a U.S. representative from Massachusetts, who became Speaker of the House. And he was as savvy a political operator as there was. And I don't remember what the question was, but I remember very clearly what the answer was. He says, all politics are local. All politics are local. I believe that, maybe because, you know, when you have a problem, you know, and you talk to somebody who's got a hammer, so everything is a nail to him. He has to bang everything down. You know, if you need a saw, he can't help you, but he needs a nail. Rabbi Edelstein works on a much larger, bigger picture environment than I do. For me, all politics is local and all the operations are local. How you tie them in together, maybe for Mrs. Yagobian, maybe the answer would be that we can't operate with day schools the way we have in the past. Maybe we have to start thinking a vision of tying all these day schools together, coming up with curricula, ideas that would work on a national or international level, and then move in that direction, having like an executive elected by lots of local day schools that could then go take a bigger picture to major funders. But to ask, to talk, to, I'm going to give you an example. When I was doing, I still do fundraising, but when I was doing it in the beginning, I was learning with a particular Balabas. And he said, you know, I'd like to make a contribution to your organization. What do you think would be an appropriate sum? So I gave him a sum. Now, he didn't blink, but he says, you know, I give that kind of money to organizations, but the organizations I give that money to are organizations that feed and clothe and house people. Sorry?
In the Soviet Union.
No, this is not, this is in America. This is in America. Actually, there are people in America who also need to be housed and clothed and fed. So I said, that's very admirable. I want to tell you something. In our organization, which was a major Bolshevik yeshiva, we have lots and lots of, you know, young men who come through. And the majority of them do not stay. But if they stay for a fairly short period of time, they're going to learn one thing for sure, and that is that they have an obligation to be philanthropic, at whatever level that happens to be. They are stewards, they're trustees of the money that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has blessed them with. And so they don't have to become from, they don't have to stay there for a long time and learn, but they stay there for a short period of time, they're going to learn that. Not because we're holding our hands out for tuition money, but in terms of the learning that we do, they learn that they have an obligation to be philanthropic, and the philanthropy starts at home. I said, you might not like the color of the stripes of me or, you know, the fellows who come out, but I can guarantee you that these are the people who are going to drive and fund the organizations that you do care about. Because right now, you know, if you have a choice between, you know, saving whales or saving snail darters or saving the Jewish people or funding people who don't have, you know, the basics in life, you know, this is where the battle is. So the point that I'm saying is when you go to funders, what you have to sell them is a vision that's not parochial. When I go to funders, I don't talk to them about, you know, the Orthodox community, the yeshivas. I talk about the Jewish people. If you want to see a future for the Jewish people, then we have to get back to the basics. You know, our parents had less money than we do, but they funded things to a much greater extent than we do. Jewish organizations, for sure, to a much greater extent than we do. Their parents had even less, and they were even more philanthropic for Jewish organizations. So if you're talking to non-religious Jews who are connected Jewishly, this will resonate with them. They will understand this. So if you have a Jewish day school that you're trying to fund, you know, you can talk about the fact that we are inculcating in these children solid Jewish values that are what you're all about. The things that you care about, that's what we care about. And these kids will come out and they will care about it as well. So it's not, you have to have a bigger picture. When I say it's local, the locality is all of Klal Yisrael in your community. And when I'm trying to sell a project, let's say a kollel or some other operation, organization that's going to be working to promote Yiddishkeit, I will tell a non-from balabas, a gevir, said, you know, you may not like what the Orthodox stand for, but I can guarantee you, if you fund this, it's going to affect the entire community. There will be a very significant spillover. It, because the Reform, the Conservative, the JCC, they're not going to sit back and let us pick off their people. And that's why you see in some of these major communities where the Orthodox outreach is very significant, they have Reform Kollelim, I don't know what they teach, but that's what they call them, and they have people coming in and learning how long they can continue to maintain them coming in, I don't know, before we eventually get them. But they are funding all sorts of things in the non-Frum community. Why? Because the Frum community has raised the level of what's acceptable Jewishly, what's expected Jewishly. So I think this is what you have to think about, is how can I take my vision and explain to some Balabas or Balabasva who's not from why it's great for the entire Jewish community. And you can do it, I guarantee you can do that. You can do it in any and with any organization anywhere.
Thank you. Yeah, Rabbi Efros. I just want to say a little before I just take one or two more questions.
Gave me the money. There you go.
That this headspace, we're starting way behind. We're starting with a level of institutional egocentricity and parochialism, whereby we don't provide any encouragement to anybody that comes to try and represent us in any kind of a way. Our reaction is, you know, I'm a Horn Wilson guy, you know, like, all right, there's Big Brother, you know, and we have to suffer him because, you know, he's giving us money, so we have to be nice to him. Not that me myself, right, but whoever it is. There's a kind of a tolerance, but not an embrace of saying, wow, you know, you can make things happen that other people can't. We've had all kinds of attempts, AJOB and their likes. We've had websites where we've asked people to post things up and share. None of these things have gotten off the ground because we haven't yet reached the level of maturity to take that care, to want to link and share what we have with others. We need to understand that we're holding by a very, very basic level. And if we want to change this whole momentum and get to doing on a consistent basis the types of things we spoke about today and what Rabbi Efros so well embellished, we need a real change of headspace. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Dean Laverne. I'm from the University of Maryland. My question is the following. What address do we go to if there are innovative ideas that we have that we want to get off the ground? I found Belize to be responsive, Rabbi Deitch to be responsive, but sometimes I found that there are ideas that could just be my ideas. I'm not great, but I found that other people have had similar innovative ideas that just haven't seemed to gotten gotten the support to get it off the ground. So what address for those of us, and these are ideas that I believe in. If I was in Hebrew to make money, I would have gotten out a long time ago. So these are ideas that I'm willing to work for a volunteer basis because I believe in it. So what address can you give me to help me launch the ideas? Obviously they need to
I can't give you one address, but I can tell you that although I've never met you, I've read several times what you wrote, three times at least, what you wrote after the Women's Campus Kirov Conference in Monsey. I can tell you the suggestions that you wrote there. Mrs. Rosenblum will confirm that I asked her, what are we going to do about this? We got some feedback. And that, you know, despite the fact that you didn't address your remarks to me, I found them pertinent enough to try and follow up on them. Now, to tell you, the best I can tell you is that there is no one address, but there are traffic directors. Okay? And I'm certainly happy to be a traffic director when, despite my continuous sense of kind of overwhelm, but to be a traffic director to such ideas and say, I think that the best way of moving this forward is A, B, C, D, E. These are the people. These are the people who would like it. Whether it's local, this should be a Ma'or idea, right? A Ma'or national idea, an American campus Kiruv idea, a Morosha international idea, an Afikim Rebbe Butler idea, all right? To try and identify where and how and who might be the resources for that particular thing. Yes.
Hi, I'm Julie Parkins from Teaneck, New Jersey. I'm not a Kirov professional. I'm one of those dreamers that you spoke about. I had a dream I was here last year when Lori Palotnik presented the Jewish Women's Renaissance Project. I wanted to bring women from Teaneck, women from Northern New Jersey. I never raised money in my life. I raised I don't know if that's a lot of money or not, $11,000 from a thriving community just by going to just people and telling them about what I was going to do. You've got these thriving Jewish communities that don't have, exactly like you said, that don't have the care of movement. So now I've got these women, I've got these 20 women, these 20 families, and I'm going to bring them back. I'm going to bring them back to a community. But we don't, like, there's so much money there. Like, I was fine. There's money in this community. There's money in these communities. But there aren't, we don't have the care of that we need.
Are you asking a question?
No, I think I'm just making a statement that that you have these communities and you can tap into them.
Yeah.
Validating what you said.
Yeah. Thank you, Mrs. Levine. I'm not used to validation. I need somebody else to recognize it. Yeah. Yes.
I just had a
question.
Susie Tullio. I was just wondering, Birthright, how successful have you been as far as keeping people? I know they don't make people cross, but I know they bring, they've got facilities.
It's a little bit longer than I have time for now, because I would have to critique the two studies that they've done, one before and one now. The sampling of, attitudes don't really matter. Okay, the average woman who does get married, just tell me when we're time up, because we're over.
Last question.
Last question?
Yes.
Okay, the average female in America is getting married at the 25 point something years of age. The average male at 28. The average first child 4 years later. Okay, the average birthright attendee is 21 years. So there's 7 years for males and 4 years for females until they get married. So the first birthright sampling of those, and that's average, right? Many get married in their 30s, many don't get married, many have alternate lifestyles, we know all of that. So the sampling was very, very small of those who got married. The original birthright study, based on an insignificant sample, said that it was very significant. Because you have to remember, attitudes, why don't attitudes matter in intermarriage in particular? Because the average person who intermarries today will tell you two things. I wanted to marry a Jew, right? I couldn't find a Jew. If I could have found a Jew, I would have preferred to marry a Jew. That's number one. And secondly, they will say that I intend to bring up my children Jewish, despite the fact that I'm intermarried. All right? So when it happens to them, they don't feel that there's so much of a difference between their initial commitment to marry a Jew and what they're doing now, intermarried. The second study on birthright already showed a significant decrease in the percentage of in marriages as opposed to intermarriages relative to the sample that they compared it with, which is those who applied for birthright who were not accepted, which is a fair comparison.
Decrease of those who married?
Of those who married Jews. Because as the sample got bigger, right, the percentage went down. The initial ones, there's a presumption on my side that people who are more committed Jewishly also get married at a younger age. Okay? So the initial sampling showed a higher percentage of more committed Jews, per force. So we don't know. What I can tell you about birthright is two things. One, birthright is clearly an idea of a secular group of people coming with a great new concept, simple, branded birthright, right? Branded in a very effective way, producing mega bucks from mega donors because of a mega vision. And that's exactly the way we should be thinking. That's number one. And the second thing about birthright is that anybody that you will find at Ben Gurion Airport who's finished a birthright is inspired. Now, whether he's inspired by the time he reaches Kennedy Airport or not is a different story. Okay? But where we have learned to tap into that inspiration, and I can tell you that between 40 and 60% of those who come on our Israel trips have been on a birthright, but I can't tell you the correlation exactly, because we've never done an in-depth study. Right? But where we're able to tap into that inspiration, and provide it with content, it is an effective startup for basic Jewish identity. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.